Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. You can get in touch with me through Twitter at Inside Ed, by email at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. My name is Sean Delaney, and if you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it on a future programme. My guest this week retired from his position as teacher educator about a decade ago, but continues to be active in education, especially outside Ireland. For thousands and thousands of teachers around the country, this week's guest was an influential and appreciated presence in their programme of initial teacher education. For teachers who graduated from St Patrick's College in Drumcondra, Andy Burke is a former lecturer and Dean of Education from the college who is remembered by those he taught for the passion and enthusiasm he brings to the disciplines of history of education and philosophy of education. I met up with Andy recently to talk to him about his career up to and since retirement and about his reflections on the state of education in Ireland today. I began, however, by asking him how he came to be working as a lecturer in St Patrick's College when I began there as a student in the mid-1980s.
I grew up in a small farm, large family, among other small farms with large families, near Bandon and County Cork. And I was very impressed by the way people constantly helped each other, particularly my own parents and all the other people in the neighbourhood. And then later, my own brothers and sisters. And I wanted to be part of this. I thought it was a great way to live. But I thought in terms that were bigger than Ireland. I thought in terms of developing countries. And I said, I'd like to go and work in them. And the way to do it was to join a religious order. So I did that. And I joined the Holy Ghost Fathers, or the Spiritans, as they are now called. And I spent a number of years with them, during which time I did a BA in philosophy with a minor in history. Then some Department of Education courses in the teaching of science, because there was a shortage of those. I taught for 2 years in Rockwell College, taught at secondary and some at primary in the prep school. And that is really what brought me into the whole area of education, because when I left, the natural thing for me to do was to revert to education. Though I didn't do that immediately, because when we were all thinking of going and working in developing countries, we also developed some practical skills, some in carpentry. I was particularly interested in electrical work, and I developed that skill. So when I left the religious order in the middle of the year, there was nothing else to do, so I went and joined the electrical trade union and worked as a full-time electrician for myself in Dublin, wearing houses and apartments. But then the following year, I decided to go back to education, taught for 2 years in Ringsend Vocational School. And during that 2 years, I did a higher diploma in education, and I started an MA in Philosophy and History of Education back in UCD, where I graduated from. But I decided that I was so busy with so many things, with teaching, still doing some electrical work, playing a lot of football and playing music at weekends, that there is no way that I would get the level of result in the MA that would get me into third level education. So I decided to give it up and go to Boston for a year to work. But I couldn't get into electrical work there, so I got into carpentry and joined the Carpenters Union and worked for a year as a carpenter. And one of the jobs I did during that time was the refurbishment of a basement for somebody that's fairly well known in Ireland, Dr. George Meadows of Boston College. He worked here on research on the examinations, and then in a major project on the implementation of standardised testing in a population where it had never been used before. But he encouraged me through the days I was working there to apply to Boston College for a scholarship to do a doctorate. I reluctantly did that. That was the year, 1968, the year of revolution in American universities. So it didn't come through that year. I came back to Ireland, finished the MA, got the kind of result that I wanted that might open some doors for me. And then in the middle of the year, went back to Boston and back to my carpentry work. On George Meadows' advice, for which I'll be forever grateful, I reactivated my application and got the offer of a scholarship to Boston College to do a doctorate. And that I did. I said, if I'm going back, I would give up everything and do it, and I did it within a 3-year period. I taught some undergraduate courses, worked with the Dean of Education, and then returned to Ireland, got a job in the research centre initially, and then switched to the college, because my strengths were not in empirical research, but kept both jobs going for a time, and that is where I met you.
That's a fascinating account, Andy, and I suppose it ties in with something that you used to talk a lot about back in the early or mid-80s, and that was about whether or not teaching is a profession or a trade. And I know that was something you were certainly interested in then. Which now do you think it is?
Yes, I thought a lot about that, because when I came back, I had a choice to concentrate on one of my academics, either philosophy or history of education. But I decided to take on the bigger issue of teaching as an occupation, because much was beginning to be written about that area of teaching as a teaching as an occupation and teacher education as a form of professional training. So I first of all had to ask myself the question, well, what kind of occupation is it? And I read people like Dreeben, the Harvard sociologist, and a whole lot of others. He made the point that many people tended to look on teaching and on professions from a sociological point of view, and have a number of checklists are they self-governing, do they have a code of ethics, and all of that. But he was critical in a way of that, even though he was a sociologist, and went more for the fundamental question, what is the heart and soul of a professional area? And it really comes down simply to this, that professional people provide a service in areas the complexity of which is known, but not fully understood. In other words, professionals profess competence in that kind of area. And like people like John Dewey were saying that in 1904, Dreeben was saying it, Denmark was saying it, Berliner and a whole lot of others were beginning to say that. And so that got me onto that wavelength, because it was a very good paradigm for looking at what teachers were doing and looking at what teacher educators should be doing. So the critical question, when I boiled it down to, if you walk onto a building site, if you walk into a hospital or wherever you walk in, say, who are the professional people? And put very simply, they're the people who make the critical decisions. And who are they? It's not the electrician, it's the electrical engineer. It's not the draftsperson, it's the architect. It's not the nurse, it's the doctor. So then you ask the simple question, who makes the critical decisions in the classroom? It has to be the teacher, whether or not they are competent to make it, whether they're trained or untrained, they still make the decisions. And Berliner, somewhere in the 80s, did a review of research on teacher decision making. And his conclusion was that teachers make up to 30 non-trivial decisions every hour of every teaching day, in a situation where 1,500 interactions take place between teacher and pupil. And that, in a way, blew me out of the water and said, that is the heart and soul of it. And that, in a way, establishes teaching, potentially at least, on the professional stage, because they are making those decisions. Teacher educators don't teach pupils. Ministry of Education people don't teach pupils. Teachers teach pupils, and they make those decisions every day. And the challenge to teacher education then is, how do we best equip them to make those critical decisions? And if those decisions were about my children, they are incredibly important. As those of us with children know, when they come home, they're upset about something. They say, oh, what happened today? What decision did the teacher make today? And decisions could be simple things like saying a nod, say, well done, or raising a finger, as Buber says to somebody. And decisions about what to teach, how to teach it. The teacher is making them all the time, every hour of every day, whether or not they're competent. The challenge is to make them as competent as we can make them. And that's what took me in that direction. I spent most of my time researching that, thinking about it, developing the implications of that for the way we should be teaching teachers, developing them.
So if teaching then is a profession, what do you make of the state of the profession of teaching in Ireland today?
I think Ireland is in a better position than many other countries because of our native good sense and our feel for what is the heart of education. But as against that, there is a tsunami coming at us from the OECD, from the EU, of narrowing down the whole thing to a series of competencies and test basing the assessment on a series of competencies and pushing the whole sort of economically fueled arguments of inputs and outputs. And that is narrowing education enormously and very regrettably. In fact, Richard Pring has written a very good article where he said, when you change the language about education to inputs, outputs and all these things, you're actually changing the definition of education. So there is pressure on to go that route, and many countries have gone that route and have narrowed education and have almost pushed foundation disciplines to one side because of doing that. And as soon as you do that, you're in a real difficulty, because a number of people have said that teachers are the people at the coalface. And if reforms are to come, they've got to understand what they're doing. And if they don't understand the why of what they're doing, it's not understand the how, they have to understand the why of what they're doing. If the teaching approach changes, they may end up replacing one orthodoxy by another uninterrogated orthodoxy, never being able to critique what they're doing, to critique their own teaching in anything more than a pragmatic way, what works, what doesn't work. And, you know, I am reminded of the things that worked in medicine, bleeding patients, you know. That word, boring holes in their heads, appeared to work. So what works is corporate punishment worked on a lot of us. But from a more informed point of view, what works may not be acceptable and may now be illegal, in fact. And without foundation discipline, without perspective, teachers are not in a position to critique what they're doing or where education is going. And that is absolutely critical, because they've got to take it there.
And yet, Andy, isn't there something about the people who are attracted to teaching as a profession that they have a real hunger or a thirst for what is practical and what will work? And as you say, a number of countries have got rid of the foundation disciplines. I wonder, are foundation disciplines more suitable for postgraduate education for teachers rather than the initial education of teachers?
You know, if it was medicine, should we just teach all the practicalities first and then teach the theory later? I think one has to make the connection between both of them. And we can't just lecture in philosophy or psychology and hope that the students will cobble some kind of connection. We've got to make the connections for them at the level at which they can take it at that time. And I think we've got to do that at every level along the way. Otherwise, we're into teacher training, are going back to teacher training, as much of teacher education is doing across the water in England and Wales, and regrettably so, they're gone back, like the University Council on the Education of Teachers, they're gone back to teachers as technicians, the doers, not the thinkers. And teachers have to be thinkers, because if reform is to be delivered, and reform will certainly come and changes will come, they're the people that have to handle it, understand it and implement it as they think best. And so we've always got to give them both the connective tissue between courses and classwork. That must always be maintained at every level, pre-service, in-service, continuing professional development, because one without the other really doesn't make much sense. And even at an early stage, you've got to give them as much as they can take. And the other point I'd make in that regard, that teacher education is particularly challenging, because one teaches the foundation courses not just for the teacher as future professional in the classroom, but you teach them also for the teacher as person. So they're performing a dual role, the education of the professional and the education of the teacher as person. And it's very interesting that Charles Silverman, many years ago, his comment on teacher programs in America was that their major flaw was that they forgot to educate the teachers. They trained them, they didn't educate them. And it's always a warning to the rest of us, make sure we've got to carry both, because they are critically connected to each other. But it's a major challenge, and there are no simple answers as to how to do it. And it can be done in different ways. Because of a very practical background and work with my hands, I always try to make and always feel I need to make that connection to the core face, to the classroom realities. That has been helpful, I think, throughout my career, and is very helpful for the past 25 years working in developing countries, where really you've got to keep your eye on the blackboard and what's happening there. But still, even with poorly educated and low academic standards among teachers, one can still find a way of making the connection. Putting on the X-ray glasses, say, of psychology or of philosophy or of sociology, that enable you to see what you're looking at. You know, psychology is an obvious example that at least you can say, well, that child isn't ready for this because he or she is at a certain stage. Now, that is enormously informative and will help you to correct, to read mistakes and not to push them where they're not ready to go. Sociology, too, will give you insights. X-ray glasses is foundations, in a way, perform the sort of function that the framework, say, in the Pompidou building in Paris, where the whole support system is visible on the outside. Foundation disciplines should perform that and should be seen to perform that. That exercise for the education enterprise. I think it's a good analogy that I've often used to explain their role. And then the dual role complicates things quite a bit for those of us who are involved in teacher education.
You're shying away from the term training for education and you prefer to talk about teacher education rather than teacher training. And yet other professions such as medical profession or the law profession are happy enough to use training in their preparation. Do you think that maybe we fuss too much about whether or not the initial preparation is training or education? Or do you think maybe training could be a prerequisite for education of teachers?
In a way, I think teacher preparation is quite unique in that the education of the educator is a critical component, is part of the technology one uses for actually teaching. They are connected and interconnected, more so than in medicine. So we've got to carry both. We've got to educate the educator and train the teacher. They're both involved, of course. But if we just talk about training, then do we neglect the person who's doing it, whose education is absolutely critical? Because these are the people who are going to engage pupils or older students in the human conversation. Now, if they haven't gone through the human conversation themselves, a very good example of that would be psychiatry. For one becoming a psychiatrist, they have to go through the whole process of being psychoanalyzed themselves. I would make the same argument for education. If you're becoming an educator, you've got to go through the rigorous process of being educated oneself. And then, of course, there's training. And we train through micro-teaching, to teaching practice, all kinds of things. But for a teacher, both elements have got to be there if they're going to claim the title of a professional or even of educator, because the scene is much bigger than just teaching knowledge and skills. It's much bigger than that. You know, some writers coming at it from an existentialist point of view, say Buber and Gabriel Marcel, they view education as the self-creation of a human being by the human being himself or herself. And Emerson would say that it's ludicrous to say that I educated somebody else, as if I did your self-making or your self-creation for you. The role is to facilitate the self-creation of another human being. What's sitting here was what I created through every decision, every experience, every reaction I've ever made. And what's there is what you created. And it's the same for the 25 pupils in my classroom. It's a matter of self-creation. And that's why Buber has that wonderful statement in the beginning of his article on education. He says, "In every hour, the human race begins. In this, as in every hour, what has not been invades the structure of what is with 10,000 countenances, not one of which has been seen before. A creative event, if ever there was one. My countenance, your countenance, our educator has got to facilitate that." And that's why Buber talks about the role of the teacher, apart from teaching knowledge and skills, there is the other role that he says is the other half of education. Because the example he uses, if you go to a master craftsman to learn something, a skill of carpentry or electrical work or wood turning, he said you learn that. But you also learn something else. Without the master craftsman being aware of it, you learned his philosophy of life. He said in the case of the teacher takes responsibility for doing that. explicitly takes responsibility for doing that. That, Buber said, that's the other half of education. It's the interpersonal contact. It's the one, what he calls the one-way dialogue, that somebody, a child grows up in the context of their parents, or a pupil grows up, develops, self-creates in the context of a well-educated teacher. And it's enormously rich and enormously challenging.
And do you think, though, that maybe we're expecting too much of the teacher then? If we want them, in addition to, say, transmitting the best of the human heritage to the next generation, if you look at that as one aspect of a teacher's job, but also you're even looking for something more, that you're actually making these new people, or helping these new people to become the people they will be. Are we putting too much pressure on a teacher's shoulder?
Well, if you thought that we should do it all in the pre-service course, we would, of course, be doing... it would be far too much to take, because it's so busy. But as I said earlier, I think we should begin doing it, but see the period of professional development as being much, much longer. Berliner says it takes about 7 years to mature as a teacher. And as many people are arguing, there should be a connection between pre-service, in-service, continuing professional development to allow that to happen. So we sow the seeds in pre-service insofar as they can be sown, and we shouldn't neglect doing that. But we have to have much more time to let them grow. The problem was with pre-service teacher education, where it wasn't connected, and still in a way is not connected with in-service in most countries, is that we felt, as teacher educators, we had to front-load everything, and we ended up overloading completely. And very often, the foundation disciplines, for instance, were not well taught in other countries. I think they were pretty well taught in this country, and people were trying to show how relevant sociology, psychology, philosophy was to classroom realities. And even history was saying, this is the way our approaches have developed. This country has been pretty good at that. Maybe we could do more. But other countries have either pushed them to one side and not making that kind of connection. So it's by viewing the teachers developed over a much longer period. Some writers have said that until that 7 years is up, you're a proto-professional. You really are just learning. It's like a young doctor. You've got that somebody, a young doctor said to me, you have to listen to thousands of hearts on the stethoscope before you begin to recognise what is a defective heart. There's a great book that really is so relevant to education. It's a book written by... an Indian surgeon in Boston called Gawande, and it's a book called Complications. And it's so enlightening as to how one develops one's professionality slowly through trial and error. And some of the errors he recounts would make you afraid to go into a hospital. But that is the only way one can learn it. But you learn it over a long period, and during that period, you're a proto-professional.
Okay, but... even if it does take 7 years for a teacher to mature, their responsibilities on the first day are very often similar to the responsibilities after 40 years.
Well, that is undoubtedly a flaw in the system. We expect them to be fully professional on the first day, which by definition they cannot be at all. And like many arguments have been made to give them a lower teaching load, to provide very good mentoring, to release experienced teachers to mentor them. And those arguments are totally acceptable. I would support them completely. To give them time to think like teachers. Now, the advantage we have now, fortunately, at last, is that the teaching practice period is much, much longer. But even then... you know, and there'll be less surprises when they start teaching on the first day. But there will still be surprises. There will still be a lot of work to be done, even though they've had longer and better teaching practice experiences in various situations. There is still a long learning period, and we have to do a lot to facilitate that more. And very often what happens, certainly in other countries, certainly in America, is that there is a huge dropout rate from teaching at that stage. And it's a huge problem, because if you don't provide the services, or if the initial teacher education is not good enough, they feel incompetent. They might be bright, but if you feel incompetent at a job, you're not going to stay at it for very long. You know, and they've also found that the graduates of 5-year teacher programs are more inclined to stay on in the profession because they've been better prepared for the profession and experience less failure. We all experience failure, but a lot of failure will drive you out of it. And that is a huge loss to the profession.
I suppose the irony is that I know a lot of parents, they like to have a young teacher, and yet a young teacher is probably not as competent as somebody who has several years' experience. Maybe to some extent the enthusiasm and energy that a young teacher brings compensates for some of what they lack in experience.
There is no doubt it does. And pupils love people who are closer to them in age. And I've learned so much from watching young teachers teach. And I say to them afterwards, I wish I could do what you've just done up there, because it's magical. I'm good at some things, you're good at other things. I'm not good at the things you're good at. Maybe I'm better than you on other things. But I would love to be able to do what you've done up there. It's just been magical. So they have all those gifts. And of course, they come from the fact that in Ireland, we are fortunate in that we draw our primary teachers from the top 25% of all those going on to third level. They're incredibly bright.
You've written about the fact that teacher education programmes, initial teacher education programmes, are overcrowded. What would you jettison?
If one reduced the level of assessment and include a lot of the assessment under the umbrella of the teaching practicum, to examine them more in a practical situation, that we wouldn't have these dozens of examinations which distract students so much and take up so much of their time. It's very difficult to do, and we're not alone in this. Medical education has the same problem. It's totally overcrowded. But with us, because we're educators, going to be educators, one needs time out. One needs time for discussion. One needs time to drink coffee and argue issues. One needs time to develop as an educator along with developing as a teacher. And some colleges have done this. They've reduced the number of contact hours very significantly and reduced the level of assessment very significantly and created more space, both for practice in schools and more space, more discussion time, you know. So I think we should do everything we can do, but it's up to individual institutions to do it in their own way. And as best they can, many faculty will be very disappointed with their time will be cut and say, how can I do the job I've been doing now with 20 sessions? You're asking me now to do it in 10. But if your students are spending far more time in the classroom, you'll achieve much more with your 10 hours talking about what happened in the classroom than you would with 20 straight lectures on the theory of whatever. And to make the teaching the fulcrum around which everything else revolves and around which everything else is integrated.
A recommendation there from Andy Burke to have more of initial teacher education assessed as part of school placement, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. If you'd like to suggest someone who would be an interesting guest on a future programme, please write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to over 200 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.